All right, Erev Tov. Once again, I welcome everyone to the series nearing its end. The Presence in the Jews, Part 25. Tonight, we'll look at the presidency of George W. Bush, the 43rd president, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ilu Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. So there are only two father-son combinations in American history to become president, the first being the Adamses, John, and his son John Quincy. And of course, George W. Bush and his father, he's the younger part of the second pair. There's similarities and there are differences between the two, and some of the similarities are uncanny. It's interesting that both sons bore the names of the same names as their fathers, with only the middle names different. In fact, the only difference between Bush Jr. and Senior is Herbert Walker, and he's just Walker, and of course John Adams and John Quincy Adams. Both spent a lifetime in their father's shadows, but overcame it, and each had achievements in their own right. Quincy was a diplomat and Secretary of State. As we learned, he was the one who was most responsible for the Monroe Doctrine. He actually wrote it. And W. was the governor of the second largest state, Texas. It's fair to say that both benefited from their fathers, and both paid a price for it as well. But John Adams died 16 months into his son's term, and with diminished communications then, John was in Massachusetts and the president was in Washington. He wasn't really a public factor. He was ailing by then as well. But W. had to live with his father. He had to try to separate, become his own person. But by the same token, because of the proximity of their presidencies, W.'s father and staff always remained a presence, sometimes welcome, sometimes uneasy, sometimes controversial, but it must be said, their love for each other is quite genuine. And W. Bush wrote a book a few years ago called 41 about his father. That was their nickname for each other, 41 and 43. And it's a very interesting read. Not to be ignored is this: in both cases, the fathers served only one term as president and then were booted from office by the people. And so the sons' elections were perceived as vindication for the fathers. Now, W. always feared suffering Quincy's fate of losing his second term, but he triumphed where Quincy stumbled. Additionally, the two Adams were separated by 24 years, but the Bushes by only 12 years, so the two were his father's administration was a living reality. And this is what's most interesting. Both Quincy and W. took office after highly contested elections, two of the most contested in American history. Both W. and Quincy lost the popular vote, and Quincy by a much wider margin. John Quincy Adams defeated by Andrew Jackson 41% to 31%, and Jackson even had an advantage in the Electoral College, 99 to 84, but that wasn't the majority. And the election was thrown to the House of Representatives, and Quincy was elected after what Jackson called the corrupt bargain with Henry Clay, who became Secretary of State. Now, W. also lost the popular vote by a little over 500,000 votes, and he squeaked by because of irregularities in Florida that had old Jews voting mistakenly for Pat Buchanan, maybe even for Ralph Nader, thinking they're voting for Al Gore or something like that. So three events that really defined the Bush presidency, and the first was his election. I would state without hesitation that all the anger and the rancor and the bitterness and the obsessive hatreds that pervade American politics until today all trace to that disputed election of 2000. And of course, the other two events were the Arab terror of September 11th, 2001, that transformed his presidency from one that would be focused on domestic affairs to one that would be fighting wars to protect the homeland, and controversial wars at that, and of course the financial collapse that shaped the end of his presidency. And we'll look at the extent of his responsibility for all three. Now, W. was the only president they ever met. I had opportunities to meet one other, but I wasn't interested. But him I met several times. He's an extremely humble and gracious person with a very self-deprecating charm and a grin. some would say, a smirk that is very Texan. And he's really the same in private settings as he is in public. I remember well his 2004 acceptance speech at the Republican convention in New York City. He said, "Some folks look at me and see swagger, which in Texas is called walking." And that's exactly what it was. He's brighter than he's given credit for. The fact is, no one gets to be president who's not bright. But it's part of the liberal trope that Republicans are always dumb. Eisenhower, Ford, they couldn't do it with Nixon. Reagan, both Bushes, and now Trump as well. It's a canard. Now, W always knew what he was doing, and he had the humility to recognize that he had to make decisions. Some turned out to be right, some he realized were wrong. He called his memoirs decision points, and about the critical decisions he had to make in life. And he writes, he doesn't know if every decision he made was right. All he knows, and Truman said a similar thing, was that it was right at the time, or the best decision under the circumstances. In fact, his library in Texas, I visited several times already, has an interactive exhibit called Decision Points Theater. It's really named after his memoirs, in which four different crises are introduced with four different possible approaches to them. The invasion of Iraq, the response to Hurricane Katrina, the surge in Iraq, and the financial collapse. And each person, you or the president, you're given four different and inconsistent analyses and recommendations on the best way to proceed. And you don't really have a whole lot of time to make the decision, and you can only choose one. So which of the options, and it's interactive, you press a button, which of the options would you choose? And you'd be surprised, if they tally the audience, you'd be surprised how often the decisions made are those that reflect the real-time decisions. Except, of course, like in life, you can make a right decision, and facts change, circumstances change, and make that decision into one that was does not look wise in retrospect. So what was his background and accomplishments? What were his relations like with Jews? How did Israel fare under his administration? We could start at the beginning. So W was the only president born in Connecticut, in New Haven, July 6, 1946. His family had been in America since the mid-1600s. That's a long time. And a distant relative, I thank Dr. Norman Zone for pointing this out to me, he's a distant relative named George Bush, a fifth cousin many times removed, same name though, who's a professor of Hebrew at NYU, published a book called The Life of Muhammad in 1830. It's not entirely complimentary. And in the early 2000s, the Arabs and those who hated Bush tried to pin the book on the president. But in 1841, this older George Bush wrote a book entitled The Valley of Vision, The Dry Bones of Israel Revived, in which he called for the restoration of Jews to the land of Israel. So this George Bush ancestor was a proto-Zionist, and he died in 1859, a year before Herzl was born. Bush's father, George Herbert Walker Bush, returned from combat in the Pacific in World War II, enrolled in Yale. As an infant, W. moved with his parents to Odessa and then to Midland, Texas, where he was raised as his father entered the oil business. When Bush was, he considered himself a real Texan, and he was criticized in the first campaign for not being a real Texan. Bush replied that he is a real Texan, he just felt it was important to be close to his mother when he was born. Now, W always considered himself a Texan, and that was one way that he detached himself from his father's Eastern high society elitist connections. And many siblings, most are known to us, but he had a sister, Robin, the first sibling born after, he was the oldest, born 1950, and she contracted leukemia in 1953, died within 7 months, with his parents spending most of their time in New York City for treatment. His mother was there the whole time. The father commuted almost every week, and it was devastating. In fact, they hadn't shared it with the now 7-year-old George, shared with him the extent of her illness, and it shaped all their lives. They each have exhibits in their museums talking about her, and even today, both father and son will cry when her name is mentioned. And Barbara Bush was so stressed, I don't think she was 30 then, so stressed during the illness that her hair turned prematurely white, and she kept it white ever since. Now, as his father had a strict, formal, respectable upbringing, George W. Bush was the exact opposite. Not that his parents didn't mean to be respectable, but he was fun-loving, he was talkative, he was boisterous, he was a party animal. So when it came time for high school, the father sent W. back east to Andover, where he had studied, which W. said was the hardest thing he ever did in his life until he became president. He wasn't a great student. He was writing an essay. You know, I always had a casual relationship, if not a challenged relationship, with the English language. So he was writing an essay about his sister's illness and death, and he ran out of synonyms for tears. So he looked in the thesaurus under the word tear, and he came across the word lacerate, which of course is a synonym for tear, not for tear. But he wrote in his essay, "The lacerates ran down my cheek," all right? And the teacher gave him an F. While he was president, all these Bushisms became famous. He was known for mangling and misusing words, confusing hostile and hostage, gracious and grateful. At one time he said someone should be persecuted as a war criminal, when he meant prosecuted as a war criminal. In any event, he became a cheerleader in high school. He was a good old boy. Very few Southerners were there. So the dean advised him not to apply to Yale, that he'd never get in. And he didn't mind going to the University of Texas, but generations of Bushes had gone to Yale, starting with his great-great-grandfather, meaning his grandfather's grandfather. And he essentially was a legacy admission. And it didn't hurt that his father was running for Congress at the time, and his grandfather Prescott Bush was still a U.S. senator from Connecticut. Now, Bush was not a very serious student, and the truth is he resented the snobbiness of the upper classmates at Yale, the elitists, and it turned him off. But he always knew he had a very clear sense of self. So he said a few years ago at a commencement address, he said that to those of you who are graduating this afternoon with high honors, awards, and distinctions, I say well done. And as I like to tell the C students, you too can be president. Now, he was a classmate and friend of the black football player, Calvin Hill. You may recall him. He played for the Cowboys after that. And his first real interaction with Jews came through a classmate, a roommate actually, who was Orthodox, with whom Bush has remained lifelong friends. And through him, Bush learned all about Kashrus and Shabbos. And that also was another major distinction between W. and his father. By age, background, temperament, Bush Sr. did not have many, if any, practicing Jews, or for that matter, any Jews in his social circle. But W. did, and like Clinton, does not have a prejudiced bone in his body. He mingles very easily with all types of people. Now, this roommate is an attorney today, and I had Shabbos lunch with him a few years, maybe about 10 years ago, and he told this story. He and his wife were invited to the White House for private dinner, just the two couples, he and his wife and George and Laura Bush. It's probably 2005, 2006. And at the dinner, Laura asked him, "Isn't it a holiday tonight?" And he said, yes, it would happen to be Purim. They'd just come from shul, from hearing the Megillah, eating at 8 o'clock at night. So she asked, what's Purim about? So he said, a mad Persian plotted to exterminate the Jewish people. So George said, when was that? So he said, 2,500 years ago. So Bush said, not much has changed. So Bush always had a great sensitivity to people, but especially to Jews. He spoke our language in a way that few do, except when it suits them politically. He understands faith. He appreciates people of faith. Someone told me in the 2000 election, he was standing on a tarmac during the campaign, he, W, and a third person, and they were talking about something Pat Buchanan had said. And Buchanan was running at the time again against the younger Bush, and W chimed in casually, "Make no mistake about it, Buchanan is a real anti-Semite." See, what's normal in politics is that Democrats will call out the Republican Jew haters while making excuses for their own, like Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, etc., and vice versa. But Bush wasn't like that. He would call out prejudice when he saw it, despite the politics. Now, he was always a prankster, and he developed very strong social skills at Yale and thereafter. Like Clinton in his own generation, everyone confronted this then with Vietnam, so he chose not to submit himself to the draft, but he enlisted in the Texas Air National Guard right after he graduated from Yale, and so he was not drafted. He could avoid the draft by enlisting. Now, it was a choice unit. There happened to be other politicians' sons in this unit as well, so although in theory his unit could have been sent to Vietnam, it was not likely. Nonetheless, Bush became a fighter pilot, which is a handy skill to have. Admittedly, his service was not very intense, and he was routinely given time off to help his father's various campaigns, but he did serve a number of years, and the allegation that his record was criticized based on forged documents is what effectively ended Dan Rather's career in 2004. It was in the service that W's drinking intensified, and he described himself as a boozy kid. When he finished the service, he was also a little lost, and he was adrift, especially with the looming shadow of his father. And consider, by this time, early 1970s, the father had been a more or less successful businessman, a congressman, and a UN ambassador, head of the Republican National Committee, the first American liaison to China, etc. W was very good at drinking. You know, he always resented being called Junior, but he actually preferred to be called W. He decided almost abruptly, surprised his parents, he decided to attend Harvard Business School, entered in the fall of 1973. He was the only president to have an MBA until Donald Trump, who was the second. After that, Bush went back to Texas, really followed his father's footsteps in a sense, started a few oil businesses, was never that successful, but he made money by selling his drilling companies to bigger companies. He ran for Congress in 1977 and was lambasted by his opponent as an outsider without any accomplishment, and just Bush just responded with jokes, brushing off the criticisms with one-liners, never attacking his opponent. He lost, and he'd never make that mistake again. In fact, he never lost another election. Negative campaigning sadly works. And it was after that campaign, or towards the end of that campaign, that his path crossed with a Texas political operative named Karl Rove, and they would be linked thereafter and forever. Something else happened during this period that would affect him in a number of ways. In 1976, he was visiting his parents in Kennebunkport, Maine. He went out with friends, got smashed, and was arrested for drunk driving. He pleaded guilty, paid a $150 fine, lost his license for a time, and then he decided to settle down. Settle down, we'll see in a moment, but the conviction came back to haunt him when the Democrats released it 1 week before the election of 2000. So obviously, they were just keeping it in store for when they thought it would have the most effect. And Bush was ahead in the polls until then, and he responded in classic fashion. "I always said that when I was young and irresponsible, I was young and irresponsible." Probably would have been best if he released the information himself early in the campaign, because then it would have muted any criticism. But the real change, he decided to settle down a few months later. He's over 30 now. 1977, he was introduced to Laura Welch, a budding librarian, and they married several months later. She's very talented, very grounded, a good contrast to his freewheeling nature. Very gracious, but make no mistake about it, very determined as well. It's not widely known, but the couple tried unsuccessfully to have children for years, and they made plans to adopt. They had filled out all the papers, and in 1981, she surprised him with the news that she was pregnant, And together they learned she was pregnant with twin girls. So, if you're ever on Jeopardy, here's an answer. Laura Bush is the only first lady ever to give birth to twins. And to W, he says, their births remained the most exciting event in his life. Now, his father was elected vice president about a year before the twins were born, and W commissioned a study about the long-term effects of these high offices on children. And what he learned is basically what we would expect. Some do well, and some go off the deep end. So he became very protective of his father, and when he got stone drunk on his 40th birthday party in 1986, he came back in a hotel, came to Laura and said, he's giving up drinking forever. And forever really meant forever. He hasn't had a drink since. He jogs a lot more than he did back then. Partly because he was 40, felt it was time to grow up. Partly because he didn't want to become an embarrassment to his father, who was going to run for president in a few years. And he did become his father's loyalty enforcer, which role he served well into the Bush White House. That some people nicknamed him Sonny Corleone for the way he dealt with his father's enemies. Not long after the election, he went back to Texas. He led a group that bought the Texas Rangers, and the team did well for him. They didn't win a pennant, but they did well. He did well also. By the time he sold his shares in the late 1990s, his $600,000 investment had become worth $14.9 million. That's a good deal, but it's not atypical of these baseball teams. Steinbrenner bought the Yankees for $10 million in 1972. And now, the Yankees are worth $3.7 billion. And even Texas today is worth $1.5 billion. In 1994, he ran successfully for governor, aided by Karl Rove, and many of his themes then remained the same as when he ran for president. The compassionate conservative, the need for standards in education, importance of the free market, etc. He was reelected in 1998, and he was the obvious choice for Republicans in 2000, with only John McCain presenting any challenge. Well, the election of 2000 was one for the ages until this most recent one. His challenger, Al Gore, was the vice president, really lacked the same warmth and personality that W had, and he could present very easily as patronizing and even entitled, even though the backgrounds were more similar than dissimilar. Gore's running mate was the first Jew on a national ticket, Joe Lieberman, but it's hard to say there was much net effect on the Jewish vote, even though it was exciting for Jews. Here are the facts. Here are the numbers. In 2000, Jews voted for the Democrats to the tune of 79%. 19% voted for Bush, which actually was an increase over Dole's 16% and Bush 41's 1992 figure of 11%. But Gore's 79% in that election basically matched Clinton's two totals of 80% and 78%. So Lieberman factor didn't sway many Jews. Well, I do know of some natural Republicans who voted Democrat just to be able to vote for a Jew on the ticket, but the anecdotes don't really change the numbers. Bush won 29 states. He won two-thirds of the territory of the United States, but he lost the popular vote, only the fourth time that had happened, by half of a percent, 550,000 votes out of 105 million cast. 48.38% for Gore to 47.87% for Bush. It was an astonishingly close election. Which state had the closest vote? No, not Florida. New Mexico. Gore won New Mexico by 266 votes. But Mexico only had 5 electoral votes. The Florida vote was disputed, but Florida had all of 25 electoral votes, and that would decide the election. So Florida was first called for Gore early in the evening. The networks retracted after midnight. Bush was ahead by a few hundred, almost even 900 votes, and it was called for him. Gore called Bush to concede at 1:30 a.m., and then he called back to retract his concession at 2:30 a.m. When he called again, Bush said, "You're not really calling to do this, are you?" And Gore said, "Yes." He had by 900 votes, absentee ballots to count. Many ballots were not filled out correctly, and that became the issue. So Florida Supreme Court was a majority Democrat, called for a hand recount, but that subjected the ballots to much subjectivity, the hanging chads that we remember well. On December 12th, Just a week before the Electoral College would meet, the U.S. Supreme Court in Bush versus Gore ruled 7-2 in a very convoluted decision that the recount violated the Equal Protection Clause because different counties had different standards as to what ballots would count, meaning the hanging chad versus the chad that had been completely gone, etc. So that violated the 14th Amendment. Bush was certified as the winner of Florida by 537 votes. I think the Times the next year did a recount, and Bush won by a little less than 300 votes in any event. But the Electoral College voted him in 271 to 266. You need 270 to win. One Democratic elector refused to vote for Gore for whatever reason. Now, these wounds have never healed. Some never considered Bush a legitimate president. And the same craziness exists today, only it's much worse today. Now, Clinton, you'll recall, had more Jews in his cabinet and on his staff than any previous president. W was the first president in decades to appoint no Jews to the cabinet, at least in his first term. It's not that big a shock when you consider how few Jews are Republicans. In fact, most of them are here tonight. There are just not that many to choose from. But Bush had many Jewish advisors, the neocons, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Dov Zakheim, Doug Feith, the latter three in the Pentagon. Perle was an advisor. Elliot Abrams on the National Security Council. Spokesman Ari Fleischer, his last chief of staff, Josh Bolton. Jews served in W's second term, such as Samuel Bodman, Energy Secretary. Anyone ever hear of him? No, you like me. Michael Chertoff became Homeland Security Secretary. And, of course, Judge Michael Mukasey, a member of KJ, became the third Attorney General. Now, Bush's foreign military advisors, at least the Jews, favored a very strong, others as well, favored a strong, assertive American military presence across the world as befitting the world's only superpower, and a friendly U.S. relationship with Israel. And Bush visited Israel twice during his term. Now, he first established, almost immediately, a department of faith-based initiatives, trying to get churches and synagogues to do the social service work rather than the government do it. But it became controversial for a variety of reasons, especially the funding issue. It still exists today in a diminished form. Bush also enacted a large tax cut. But he was overtaken by events. He entered office with three consecutive budget surpluses, with projections of surpluses as far as the eye could see. But when he took office, it was already a recession, and the tech bust had sharply diminished government revenues, eliminated the surplus. Moreover, he increased spending dramatically, the most of any president since LBJ, because no one could beat Obama. And particularly military spending, including Medicare, the prescription drug benefits, Social Security, and other programs, and then the wars against Arab terror. Even with his tax cuts, government revenues increased by $500 billion from his first to last year, but spending increased $1.2 trillion, so that's not a good equation. And as we know, the bottom fell out at the end of 2007. He also enacted the No Child Left Behind program together with Ted Kennedy, that increased funding for public education, meaning teachers, but at the same time insisted on standardized tests that would measure student progress and evaluate the quality of the teachers. So unions opposed the latter. They supported the former, the money, but that was the compromise. Added to the compromise, affected us, was Bush's abandonment of his support for private school vouchers, which pleased the unions and Kennedy, but greatly disappointed advocates in our community and Bill Bennett as well. That would have helped Torah education too. American Jews, overwhelmingly secular Democrats, never warmed to Bush, despite his outreach and his sensitivity to Jewish issues. Few presidents showed as much deference to Israel as did Bush, as we'll see. And yet Jews did not respond politically or electorally. And it became clear that support for Israel was no longer a dominant motivating factor in Jewish voting patterns. And as long as a candidate said the right thing, it did not matter what he did. So Bush was a magnet for Jewish criticism. Part of it was he was Republican, Part that he was a Bush, even though his father was a different temperament altogether. And part was that he was committed in faith and religious in practice. And many Jews, especially the less pious, are uncomfortable around Christians of faith, especially evangelical Christians. Truth be told, his mother was not too happy when he became an evangelical. They were Episcopalians, you know, moderate. They didn't take anything that seriously, but he took everything seriously. Of course, Bush's tenure will always be defined by war and by September 11, 2001, which was called the first foreign attack on American soil since the War of 1812. It was a shock, as we all recall. What we should also recall was the prior attacks that were not handled adequately. The first terrorist attack of this nature, radical Islam, was the assassination of Meir Kahana, Shem Yikom Damo, November 5th, 1990, in New York City. El Said Nosser, the murderer, was first acquitted of murder by a state court, convicted only of gun possession, go figure that one, was part of the same cell that later bombed the World Trade Center February 26, 1993, right after Clinton took office. That cell was funded by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. You can draw a straight line from the Kahana assassination to 9/11, but the problem was that the response was one of law enforcement and prosecution and crime and punishment, as opposed to recognizing that there's a growing movement in the Muslim world dedicated to war against the against America and the West. Of course, not all Muslims, not most Muslims, but easily by current statistics, there are about 100 million Muslims in the world dedicated to this jihad. So these were the early Al-Qaeda attacks, although the organizational name was not widely known until the attack on the USS Cole, October 2000, that killed 17 American sailors off the coast of Yemen, but also did not draw much of a response from Bill Clinton, who was leaving office. So it was clear that Bush was sensitive to terror that was out there, but it was not a high priority for the American government in 2001. They knew of threats, but nothing specific, and arcane rules prevented various agencies from pooling their information and identifying and preempting potential threats. So what was missed, among other things, was that too many Muslims, non-citizens, were suddenly attending flight school and, oddly, practicing takeoffs and flying, but not landing. And then came Tuesday morning, September 11th, and our world's never been the same. Bush was in an elementary school in Sarasota when the news came, reading to kindergarten children. Wisely, he did not panic or run out of the room in order not to scare the children, and for that he was criticized by the critics. What became clear immediately was that America had no plan, no emergency response in place. Bush was flown to several locations that day. He was banned by the Secret Service from returning to the White House. They said it was not safe until the late afternoon. He defied them and he said, basically, "I'm the president, take me back to Washington." And there he addressed the nation from the office. All other air traffic was halted for a week in America. That night he reached his parents, who were in a motel in Wisconsin. He said to his mother, "What are you doing in Wisconsin?" And she said, "You grounded our plane." That's why. By his own admission, he took refuge in and comfort from the Bible. He ended his speech to the nation that night, "Gam keilech begeitz amavas, lo irok yato imadi." And he had the triple responsibility of reassuring the American people, protecting the nation from further attack, and waging war against the Arab evildoers. Whatever criticism is leveled against Bush, he has always said that his primary achievement as president was that there was never another attack against the U.S. while he was president, and it was not for lack of trying. That was a tense time. That very night, September 11th, a plane flew near the White House, and the Bushes were rushed to the safe room in the middle of the night. It turned out to be a stray F-15, slightly off course. For weeks, there were routine bomb threats called into the White House. It was the new normal. In the days that followed, There were memorial services where he was a comforting presence, a visit to the Pentagon, Bush's emotional visit to the World Trade Center, where he was shocked by the devastation and he exclaimed to loud applause, "The people who knocked down these buildings will hear all of us soon." And people stood along the West Side highways going to the Javits Center, cheering Bush's motorcade. He was in the car with Rudy Giuliani, who was the mayor. People wildly applauding Bush. And Rudy said to him, "I hate to break you, Mr. President, but none of these people voted for you." And it's true. And then it was back to business planning response. Now, the government knew immediately it was Osama bin Laden. He was on the radar, and Al-Qaeda. But waging war against a non-state actor is not a simple matter. There's no address, and even their hideouts are located in real countries and hidden among civilians. No perfect answer has yet been offered to that problem of how to fight these asymmetric wars. Bush laid down his marker immediately. "We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them." And later, "Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists." And what he decided not to do was what he called pound sand. The Clinton response of massive ordnance on targets that were meaningless. But what could he do? The terrorists were based in Afghanistan, stretching into Pakistan. By his own admission, Bush was not widely informed about foreign policy when he became president, and he relied heavily on his advisors, Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld. Cheney was the vice president, Rumsfeld was the secretary of defense. The Jews in his administration, Pearl, Wolfowitz, Abrams, Feith, was primary foreign policy influences. And they were famous as the neoconservatives who favored a robust foreign policy and the projection of American power across the world, and especially the spread of freedom. Conversely, it was Condoleezza Rice, who was the first national security advisor, and Colin Powell, who were not really part of that ideology. Bush had not even traveled widely before he became president, although in 1998 he did visit Israel. He was shepherded around in a helicopter by Ariel Sharon, and he was amazed, really astounded at the narrowness of Israel. Sharon said to him, they were flying over the Samaria, the Shomron, and he pointed out the sites, including places where he fought, and he showed from Tulkarm to Netanya, Israel's the narrowest width of Israel was 9 miles from the border to the sea. And Bush said, 9 miles? We have driveways in Texas that are longer than that. He visited the Kotel as well, and that visit gave Bush a natural sensitivity to Israel's problems. And once the U.S. was visited with Arab terror, the empathy and coordination increased even more. Bush, unlike his father, did not seek a formal coalition or approval from the U.N. before attacking Afghanistan. But he created what he called an informal coalition of the willing. "You're with us, fine. If not, stay to the side." That was the advice of Donald Rumsfeld, who claims that he got it from Benjamin Netanyahu, who was out of office at the time, but he said that America would be too restricted in waging this war if it sought international support. So the war against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan began in October and was finished within a month, with the Taliban driven out. New democratic elections held in Afghanistan for the first time. Bin Laden escaped to Tora Bora, where they were heavily bombed in December, but he made his way to the mountains and caves of Pakistan, where he lived out the rest of his life. And even Afghanistan has never been fully quieted, and its relative stability under Bush was squandered by Obama. It was after this action, Bush's popularity reached 90%, like his father's had. And a number of measures were enacted to increase security in the United States, all still controversial. More surveillance, more wiretapping, the Patriot Act, especially enhanced interrogation of Muslim suspects, some of whom were, so to speak, interviewed in black sites, secret centers across the world where the CIA could use whatever means they wanted to. In Poland, in Romania, in Thailand, and elsewhere. And most of these people were eventually brought to Guantanamo. All of these issues, every point, was discussed at length. There were sharply divergent views within the administration, and whatever was adopted, they're all eventually challenged in the courts that upheld most of the provisions. But it must be said that the administration was understandably shell-shocked by 9/11 and greatly feared another, even more devastating attack. And if we think back to that period of time, constant fears, a dirty bomb, nuclear bomb, anthrax, remember that scare? It was the next stage that provoked the great controversy that hasn't ended, the war in Iraq. Was the war against Iraq warranted, justified, necessary? For sure, it was influenced by what had happened on September 11th. In the wake of 9/11, there was heightened sensitivity to the possibility that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And of course, he did have them one time. He used them against the Kurds in the 1990s, murdered thousands of them, and he boasted repeatedly of his WMD program, repeatedly defying the UN inspection regime. Now, Clinton had adopted regime change, getting rid of Hussein, as U.S. policy. Bush continued that, and the world's intelligence agencies, really bar none, the CIA, the Mossad, MI6 of the British, the Germans, the French, the Russians, they were all certain such a program was ongoing. Remember George Tenet, who was no friend of Israel, slam dunk that he has WMDs. Typical of the fear was Condoleezza Rice's statement that we can't wake up one morning to a mushroom cloud over our cities. And on January 29th, 2002, Bush identified three countries as the axis of evil in the world: Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. The first two, of course, avowed enemies of Israel, and the third to become one when North Korea later secretly gave a nuclear reactor to Syria to cause trouble. Of the three, Iraq was the easiest to deal with, and so came first. So Bush easily won congressional support for the war, 77 to 23 in the Senate, 296 to 133 in the House, and supporters included that whole roster: Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, John Edwards, Joe Biden, and a host of others. To be sure, Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, was among those less convinced, along with some of the older Bush crowd, like Brent Scowcroft. But Bush 41 himself told his son, "You've got to try everything you can to avoid war. But if the man won't comply, you don't have any other choice." Every president makes decisions that will be second-guessed forever, and for Bush, this was it. Now, Israel was enormously supportive of the war. Zocha malachcha nasa de'acherim. If you merit it, others do the work for you. It was an ancillary benefit. It would weaken a primary foe. I mean, obviously, we recall 1991, Saddam Hussein shooting Scud missiles into Israel that could have been equipped with chemical weapons. And there was a moral argument in favor of the war made by Elie Wiesel. After all, Saddam Hussein was a mass murderer. Elie Wiesel told Bush that he's generally opposed to war, but, I quote, "You have a moral obligation to fight evil." And here, there was no other option. And Bush later wondered why critics never acknowledged Wiesel's moral argument. And, of course, if you heard today's news out of Syria, you wonder, Is there not a moral obligation? And if there's not, why isn't there? And finally, there was this component of the Bush doctrine, the desire to spread democracy throughout the world. Now, Bush was profoundly influenced by a book he read, he published in 2004. So the ideas were in his mind all along. He harbored these ideas, but they were crystallized in this book called The Case for Democracy, written by Natan Sharansky. The known name and the unknown name was now quite known. Ron Dermer is now the Israeli ambassador to the United States. In short, they argued in The Case for Democracy that replacing dictatorships with democracies is always justified because it betters people's lives and leads to less war, as democracies rarely wage war against other democracies. And this was also deeply ingrained in the American ethos. I saw last week, just reading something else, Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1809, as soon as he left office, Jefferson described the U.S. as, I quote, trusted with the destinies of the solitary republic of the world, the only monument of human rights, and the sole depository of the sacred fire of freedom and self-government, from hence it is to be lighted up in other regions of the earth, if other regions of the earth shall ever become susceptible of its benign influence. All right, even if Bush could not write like that, he really felt it. And this I know personally. So I first met Bush at the Hanukkah party in 2003. It was just small talk. He was very comfortable in his own skin. He was a natural politician. I invited him to Bnei Yeshurun. He didn't take me up on the offer. I'll tell you why. I offered my services to help him win New Jersey in 2004, to which he said, that would take a miracle. At which point, both Laura and I blurred out simultaneously, well, Hanukkah is a time of miracles, but you know, as the modern campaigns are, you write off the states that you can't win. It's a waste of time and money. I was invited to a more private meeting at the White House in September 2004, about 10 rabbis of different stripes, and he met with us for almost 90 minutes, discussing a wide range of topics. A few points that struck me that I'll never forget. First, he was there before us. It took us a little time to get through security, but Bush, like I mentioned last week, was always punctual. Ran the White House like clockwork, and the Secret Service appreciated that as well. You could set your watch to Bush. It was Tzom Gedalia that day, and having been told that some rabbis were fasting, he didn't even put water on the table, which was very unusual. Usually it's something to drink. And I was told later that once he learned it was a fast day, he didn't think it was polite if he would drink and some people present could not drink. He spoke on a large variety of topics without a note, fielded dozens of questions. He was well versed in everything, didn't miss a beat on the policies, the politics, the various sides, the American interests in each matter, domestic and foreign. Only a tendentious idiot would think he's unintelligent. He knew everything, but he speaks in a very folksy way with a charming Texas accent. In fact, someone asked him, how did you feel when you heard about the World Trade Centers? And he said, it made me mad. All right, which I guess is what you would expect. I chimed in a few times, but I only asked for one thing, to consider clemency for Jonathan Pollard. Now, I said that Pollard was not his problem, that Pollard is really our problem, but that only he is in a position to rectify it. And of course, he was non-committal. I mean, his father was the head of the CIA, so it's unlikely he would do anything about it. But I was later lambasted by representatives of a major Jewish organization for even raising the issue. And so it goes. They don't raise the issue because they feel it won't help. On the other hand, if you don't raise the issue, it's a signal that you don't care. So I was never again invited to meet Bush, no fault of his, but I'm sure it had something with that. Someone made a crack about your great friend, Saudi Arabia, and Bush said calmly, and this made a deep impression on me, he said, the Saudis are allies, but they're not friends. Israel is an ally and a friend, and I know the difference between the two. At the meeting, this is the point I was getting to, he laid out his vision of a world of democracies, which really was Sharansky's vision. And he said that, again, even the Russian Jews, if there had been no democratization movement in the Soviet, it never would have happened. And he laid his vision of a dream of democratizing the Arab world and what a boon it would be for them and their people and for Israel and the world. And I couldn't help think at the time, I sat right across from him and thought, the words still linger in my mind. I said, poor guy, he really means well, but he doesn't realize that democracy is not a good fit in that part of the world. So his ideas were being shaped by Sharansky, but even Sharansky didn't fully appreciate that Westerners admire democracy, but Arabs don't. It's not a value for them. Russians don't. It's not a value to them. And if it's not really part of a nation's political DNA, it's not such an easy sell. Some peoples just prefer strong men who will take care of them. In a nutshell, that's where his Iraq policy collapsed. He waited months before invading in March 2003, but the war proceeded very smoothly. The war went better than the post-war. And Bush writes that he made a big mistake standing in front of that mission accomplished banner on the USS Lincoln. He says he hadn't seen it, and in any event, it wasn't a reference to the war, but to the mission of that ship. But the stagecraft was terrible. It looked like he was gloating, and it looked like everything was finished, and they made mistakes on the ground. The interministration removed the entire class of Iraqi bureaucrats, politicians, leaders, anyone who served under Saddam Hussein, and that just precipitated a civil war that hasn't really ended, which first Iraqi rebel groups and then radical Shiites, and years later ISIS became involved. With the policy floundering, the war became intensely unpopular. Democrats who supported it ran for cover. People were getting killed all around. Bush decided in 2007 in favor of a plan by General David Petraeus and his mentor, General Jack Keane, you all know him from Fox News now, to surge forces into Iraq. By now, Rumsfeld was replaced by Robert Gates, who's a more lukewarm friend of Israel than Rumsfeld. The new Secretary of State, Condi Rice, was against the surge. But Bush challenged her, what's your better idea? And Bush correctly felt it was the only hope to stop the carnage in Iraq. When announced in prime time, he said with class, the war's not gone the way they hoped it would, especially the post-war. And even though they had captured the Saddam Hussein in late 2003 and he was already executed, and he said these words, pretty rare coming from leaders, where mistakes have been made, the responsibility lies with me. It was a tremendous risk. Now we know the Joint Chiefs of Staff were opposed to the surge. But he did it. And by all accounts, the surge was an unqualified success and left Iraq relatively stable by the time Bush left office. For Obama, who opposed the war and the surge, obsessed over complete pullout of American forces. And after he carried that out, Iraq descended to chaos and became a base for ISIS, from which they're now just recovering. He had bad luck. He had bad luck in Katrina as well in 2005. So I don't want to inject myself into the story, but I've been in New Orleans with Karen 2 months before, July 2005. Another hurricane loomed, whatever its name was. And people, we watched, we were just tourists. People cleared out of the city. You couldn't move because every car was heading north. But the hurricane shifted course and didn't even rain in New Orleans. When Katrina landed in September, I sensed that the people would feel it was just another false alarm, and it wasn't. And New Orleans is built below sea level. It's a strange thing. And when the levees collapsed, the whole city flooded. Bush flew over New Orleans to see the damage, but he refused to land. And he reasoned that security for him would distract from relief efforts. But it was depicted by the media as uncaring, as he was looking at the calamity and just flying away from it. And Bush admitted the decision was right, but the optics were bad. And then his offer of federal help to send federal troops in to stop the looting, the rioting, the offer was refused by the Democratic governor and the Democratic mayor of New Orleans. But only Bush was blamed for that. Dishonest media, the fact is, also bad luck. And it brings us to Israel. W entered office 6 weeks before Ariel Sharon became prime minister. And while Israel was suffering through a brutal terror war, almost daily attacks, suicide bombs, car bombs, shooting, it's a relentless evil. Bush spoke to Arafat 3 times as president, never met him, broke off all contact in January 2002 when Israel intercepted the Karin A ship that was smuggling weapons from Iran to Gaza. And he writes, Arafat lied to me and I never spoke to him again. And not wanting to repeat what he considered the mistake of the first Lebanon War that almost sabotaged his career, Sharon waited and waited through hundreds of deaths and thousands of wounded, innumerable attacks, until he could be assured of public support. And that would happen after the suicide bombing of the Park Hotel in Netanya on Seder night in March 2002 that killed the Nebuch 30 Jews. And a few days later, Israel began Operation Chomat Magen that lasted 7 weeks. Israel took control of the cities it had relinquished to Arab rule. Arafat was confined to his compound in Ramallah, raging madly, but his support had waned. Enemies of Israel tried to prop him up and weakened the effort with a false claim about a massacre in Jenin, but that was disproved, and the White House essentially gave Sharon a green light. Bush. And just note the contrast to what came after him. I refused to accept the moral equivalence between Palestinian suicide attacks on innocent civilians and Israeli military actions intended to protect their people. My views came into sharper focus after 9/11. If the U.S. had the right to defend itself and prevent future attacks, other democracies had those rights too. And he added in a Rose Garden speech, terror must be stopped. No nation can negotiate with terrorists, for there is no way to make peace with those whose only goal is death. All Bush told Sharon was try to avoid civilian casualties. But when the Saudis demanded that Sharon free Arafat and withdraw from Ramallah, Bush publicly called for a withdrawal. Enough is enough. Sharon held firm. And Bush then decided to apply his democracy plan to the land of Israel. And that initiated a major policy shift. For the first time, the U.S. endorsed the Palestinian state alongside Israel. So those who think this policy goes back decades and therefore Trump's vacillation is a dramatic shift, they're not being honest. But even Bush's shift was conditional. June 24th, 2002, Bush said in the Rose Garden, and it's three paragraphs, but it bears hearing, it is untenable for Israeli citizens to live in terror. It is untenable for Palestinians to live in squalor and occupation, and the current situation offers no prospect that life will improve. Israeli citizens will continue to be victimized by terrorists, and so Israel will continue to defend herself. In this situation, the Palestinian people will grow more and more miserable. My vision is two states living side by side in peace and security. There is simply no way to achieve that peace until all parties fight terror. Yet, at this critical moment, if all parties will break with the past and set out on a new path, we can overcome the darkness with the light. Peace requires a new and different Palestinian leadership so that a Palestinian state can be born. I call on the Palestinian people to elect new leaders, leaders not compromised by terror. I call upon them to build a practicing democracy based on tolerance and liberty. And if they pursue these goals, America will support their efforts. And he goes on and on. Well, Bush's speech caused an uproar, and not for why you would think. Not because he endorsed the Palestinian state, but because he finally abandoned Arafat. And the Allies were incensed and disappointed. And Bush told them, and I mean Tony Blair, Jacques Chirac, Jean Chrétien, and others, Arafat would never be a partner for peace. And in that, he was much more prescient even than Rabin and Peres and the others who drank the Kool-Aid. You know, after all, Arafat was a Nobel Peace Prize winner. In his speech, there was something for everyone to support, meaning Israel's right to defend itself, and the state has to be a peaceful one. Arafat is gone, has to be gone, but also Palestinian state. The Arabists in the State Department were appalled at the rejection of Arafat. Bush's own mother mockingly called him the first Jewish president. Couldn't believe that he would go against the State Department and the rest of the world. Such things are just not done. In the White House, always, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice were far tougher on Israel, and they recommended against this move of abandoning Arafat. And generally, Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld were the most fervent supporters of Israel and strongly backed Israel's right of self-defense against Arab terror and getting rid of Arafat. But by conditioning the Palestinian state on a new government not compromised by terror and a new leadership, Bush actually helped Israel enormously. He supported the security wall that Sharon built. And in the really far-reaching change in American diplomacy, Bush sent a letter to Sharon dated April 14, 2004, that thanked Sharon for the details of the disengagement plan, that acknowledged Israel's right to defend itself, and then he said, as part of a final peace agreement, Israel must have secure and recognized borders, which should emerge from negotiations between the parties, UN resolutions, in light of new realities on the ground, including already existing major Israeli population centers. It is unrealistic to expect that the outcome of final status negotiations will be a full and complete return to the armistice lines of 1949, and all previous efforts to negotiate a two-state solution have reached the same conclusion. It's realistic to expect, Any final status agreement will only be achieved on the basis of mutually agreed changes that reflect these realities. What's the point? For the first time, the U.S. acknowledged that Israeli settlements built in Judea Samaria would remain. And that began the whole notion that Israel would retain settlement blocks in any agreement. That shift, American acquiescence to Israeli settlements in Dan Shomron, was so dramatic that it was immediately renounced by Hillary Clinton when she became Secretary of State. She said it was just a private agreement between Bush and Sharon, they're now both gone, and it does not bind the American government. Totally false, but that's what she did, and that was the policy thereafter. And Bush never called the settlements illegal because he never thought they were. By the way, to anyone who thinks that the Americans somehow masterminded the expulsion and retreat from Gaza, so it's not so. I was at the White House in the summer 2004. It was a briefing by Elliot Abrams, and he said this was purely an Israeli initiative. As he said, we're trying to destroy all bases of radical terror in the Middle East. Why would we want one created in Gaza? So it really did not accord with American interests. In fact, Colin Powell opposed the disengagement from Gaza, which he saw as an end run around diplomacy. Bush supported it in order to shake things up, but they're powerless to stop Israel from this as other self-destructive acts. The world always supports Israeli retreats. Bush's warmth towards Israel and Jews was not reciprocated, and even after his unquestioned support for Israel and its terror war against the Arabs, Bush won only 24% of the Jewish vote to John Kerry's 76% in 2004. And Kerry, as we later saw when he was Secretary of State, was often openly hostile to Israel. For a Republican president, policy towards Israel has nothing to do with the Jewish vote, which they can't win, nor for a Democrat for whom the Jews will always vote. So how odd and how exasperating. Nonetheless, Bush won a close race, but by 3 million votes, 50.7% to 48.3%, 286 to 251 in the Electoral College. He won 31 states, but again, it was the 25 electoral votes of Florida that put him ahead. But this time he won Florida by 380,000 votes. They'd already changed their voting system. Arafat died a few days after Election Day, and he was succeeded by Mahmoud Abbas, and the long, tedious dance of roadmaps and endless negotiations began. But Abbas lost big league in 2006, January 2006, to Hamas just a few weeks after Sharon was incapacitated by a stroke that left him suspended for 8 years between heaven and earth. And there was another bad decision by Condi Rice. Amazing, she made one bad decision after another and yet received accolades. Israel pleaded with her not to support the elections between Fatah and Hamas because Hamas would win. She said, "Af al pi kein." By the summer of 2007, the first battles for Gaza took place in the wake of the Hamas rockets and missiles that were pummeling Israel's south. By the way, Rice also orchestrated the failed policy of placating North Korea with the food and money in exchange for a halt to their nuclear weapons program. Clinton did the same. That didn't work either. A year earlier, Israel had gone to war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, and again the administration was divided. Rice moved for immediate ceasefire, while Cheney and Bush decided that Israel should finish off Hezbollah once and for all. But Israel botched the operation. They were unprepared to fight it. It achieved few of its objectives, and when dozens of Lebanese civilians were killed in a bombing, Bush changed course and called for a ceasefire. But perhaps the biggest change from Clinton to Bush, and then from Obama to Bush, was that Bush entered office thinking these Mideast peace negotiations were a fool's errand, and he's not going to run around the world wasting his time, as did Clinton. And even more, Cheney argued persuasively that unlike the diplomatic dogma, the conflict in Israel was not the root of all the problems in the region. And even if it could be solved, which it can't, even if it could be solved, the issues of radical Islam and the repression the Arab world has would still remain. So they rightly refused to obsess on it. The rest of the world did. And Bush once remarked privately that when the Europeans talk about Israel, they sound like anti-Semites, which also hasn't changed today. Nonetheless, diplomacy is also a business. There are people, diplomats are in that business. So Bush held a conference at Annapolis in November 2007, trying to reach out a peace deal between Abbas and Sharon's corrupt successor, Ehud Olmert. But all they succeeded in doing was agreeing on an eloquent declaration to negotiate. A weakened Olmert, on his way out of office and years later to prison, even offered more generous concessions than did Barack at Camp David in 2000, but he could not persuade Abbas to sign on. And here Bush loses me when he speaks of the people wanting peace being thwarted by extremists on both sides. It's just not true. When 80% of a Palestinian society can support suicide bombings, it's not that both sides want peace. In early 2007, Israel informed the U.S. that North Korea had furnished a nuclear reactor to the Syrians that was being weaponized at Al-Khaibar. Israel asked that the U.S. bomb it. Rice was staunchly opposed. Gates was staunchly opposed. Cheney supported it. He liked bombing. Bush decided that he would not, do anything. He would say nothing and do nothing. On September 6, 2007, Mivtza Bustan, in the dead of night, Israel bombed the reactor in Syria to smithereens and said nothing about it for 7 months. That itself was as shocking as the operation, Olmert's only success as prime minister. Now Bush also had a deal with Iran, and under his watch, the strict sanctions regime came into effect that also disrupted the flow of terrorist money across the world. So a list was developed by banks and companies doing business with Iran. This was the initiative of an undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence named Stuart Levy, a Jew from Akron, Ohio, who was so good at what he did that Obama kept him on for 2 years, and is so good that he's now on the short list for the FBI director's job, Stuart Levy. Within 1 year, with this we close, Bush was almost powerless. 1 year after the 2004 election, his plan to partially privatize Social Security failed, and with Iraq in turmoil, his popularity sank. Elections of 2006 cost the Republicans the Congress, what Bush called a thumping. His term was winding down. He expected a quiet departure when the financial world collapsed, along with the stock market. It'll be decades before there's any real clarity as to what happened, but suffice it to say that the housing market collapsed from a bubble that was caused by extremely liberal lending policies that encouraged home ownership for people who could not afford it. And these subprime loans were then repackaged and sold and resold to investment banks, and when the owners defaulted on their mortgages, these banks were ruined. Now, in 2003, Bush had tried several times in vain to rein in his lending practice. We remember it, 5% down, no income verification. Yeah, that'll work. But when he opposed it and wanted to change it, he was accused of racism, and Democrats opposed any change, especially Barney Frank. Lehman Brothers went under, whole industry suffered, unemployment skyrocketed, it was a cascade effect throughout the economy, and the enormous upheaval in financial systems across the world. Recovery's been long and slow, the stock market has bounced back, but here's some news, the same housing lending practices are being restored today as well, so it's a terrible cycle. Well, it's hard to blame Bush for it. Every president is responsible for what happens on his watch, and the same with the Arab terror of 9/11. So today, Bush is rated in the lower end of presidencies, but that can at least be partly attributed to the frenetic partisanship that exists today. I do think history will judge him better than he's judged now. It already does, much like Harry Truman, as none of the crises he confronted present with obvious solutions that were not chosen, and all of them have to be perceived through the prism of a relentlessly hostile media still angry over the results of election 2000. If you look at his economy, 2001 to 2007, it looks a lot better than at the end of 2008. Alas, he served a full 8 years, And Obama had his fun blaming Bush for everything for many years. And even the war looked better when Bush took office than it does today. But in retrospect, if Saddam Hussein had not been removed and had restarted his nuclear weapons program or purchased weapons from North Korea, as Syria tried to do, we would be excoriating Bush for his dereliction of duty in not going to war, much as we might several years from now with Obama and Iran. Who knows? Roughly 4,500 Americans were killed in these wars. 4,500. Every life is precious. Every family suffers. And the sacrifice is great. In perspective, 7,000 Americans were killed in the 2 days at Gettysburg, and over 400,000 were killed during World War II. But the question still remains, to what objective and were the goals achieved? So to date, the answer is a qualified yes, because he kept the country safe, which after all is the sine qua non of a president. But the book is still open. For Jews, Bush was a friendly, caring presence who was not appreciated as he should have been, and the more Obama's negativity made Jews uncomfortable, the more they disliked Bush. But as I said in reference to Pollard, that's our problem, not his problem. And for sure, the history of his presidency is still in its first draft. I thank you all very much.